This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Perfect Dharma is rarely met with even 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Thank you to Reverend Myo for inviting me to come up from Santa Cruz today and practice with you all. It's a beautiful temple here. I've been a few times before, but it's been years. Must be about 7 years or something since I've been here. Myo and I practiced together at Tassajara years ago, and I appreciate maintaining our connection. And some of you have probably finished Rohatsu Sesshin, as we have down in Santa Cruz. And we're finishing up a year of practice. One of our study themes for this year that we're finishing has been bodhicitta. Do y'all know bodhicitta? The aspiration for complete awakening only for the benefit of all beings. Or we might even say, like, the wish to completely free all beings from suffering. And in order to do that, we want to be awake. It's the birth of a bodhisattva, traditionally defined as when bodhicitta arises, when this aspiration first arises. Based on opening to the suffering of the world, opening to many, many humans and other sentient beings not content, greatly suffering, slightly suffering, wanting things to be different. We see this predicament, and the heart of compassion opens, which is in Buddha Dharma defined as also like a wish, actually. Compassion is the wish that others be free from suffering. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. That heartfelt wish for all beings is, or for any one being, but for all beings is this all-encompassing compassion. And then bodhicitta is a little step in addition to that compassion. It's saying, may everyone be free from suffering, and that's the particular dharmic twist on it now is, it seems to me like the way that we're going to be free from suffering is to truly and deeply understand what is this suffering, what is this discontent. And we see in the end it comes down to self-grasping, self-concern, holding this view of the small, independent, separate self is the root of all other types of discontent. And so when we see that, we wish all beings to be free from this self-concern. And in order to help them, then this is why I must become Buddha. I must be Buddha. In other words, I must be free from self-concern to understand how it works and to help others find that way too. So, big aspiration. Almost like as big as it could possibly be. And, you know, impartially for all beings throughout space and time. And traditionally there's sometimes said to be these three types of aspiration, bodhicitta. The analogies are the king-like bodhisattva, which would be first establishing oneself as like a dharma king, being Buddha, being completely free from self-concern oneself, and from that position of great power and authority, we might say, then totally compassionately helping all the subjects of the kingdom, king-like bodhicitta. And we might think, well, in order to really help everyone be free from suffering, wouldn't we have to be free from it ourselves? Almost logically, it might sound that way. And something like that would be this king-like bodhicitta, the aspiration to awaken for all beings. But then another version is the ferry boat pilot, bodhicitta, which is like not so much being Buddha first and then helping all the suffering beings, but more like we're all on the boat going to the other shore of freedom together, and nobody goes first or after. We're all go together across, but we're the pilot, so we're steering the boat, and we all go together. And from a maybe kind of a non-dual point of view, we might think, well, this would maybe be the only way it could really work, actually, because from the perspective of awakening, aren't all beings awakened together always? Isn't, if there's no separation. So this is another type of bodhicitta. And then the third is the shepherd-like bodhicitta, which is just taking care of the sheep and helping them all to be happy and sheltered and well-fed and content, and may they be free from suffering. And as the shepherd, I'm willing to stay out in the camping in the rain under a tree or something to take care of these sheep. Almost like, so they go first. They realize this freedom from suffering first. They become Buddha. So these three types of bodhicitta are basically about who goes first. The king-like one is, well, I go first. I have to, because I must in order to know how to help them. The ferry boat pilot is like, well, we all go together. And shepherd-like bodhisattvas, all beings go first, and when all beings throughout space and time are completely free from self-concern and awake and clear, then I can go too. And in that kind of presentation of these three types of bodhicitta, it's not really seen like any are like really better than any others. They're all legitimate in a way. And maybe there's just ways of talking to emphasize different different spirits of how we might practice. But in our tradition, in Dogen Zen, Dogen seems to emphasize this third one, this shepherd-like way. He has a Shobo Genzo essay called Arousing Bodhicitta, Hotsu Bodai Shin, or generating this aspiration, altruistic aspiration for awakening. And he says this bodhicitta means the wish or the intention, the aspiration. May I awaken all beings before myself. He very clearly says, others before myself. And I take this to be like, it just really pushes on our usual way of like, well, actually, don't I have to go first? It pushes our compassionate selflessness, even if it maybe doesn't make sense logically. And you know, if we kind of logically debate this point, it may not make much sense, because how can we bring all beings to this perfect freedom around the you know, subtle understanding of no self-centeredness at all, unless we really understand that ourselves. And yet, that's the spirit, is others first. We might even say, maybe that the hidden trick here is that if we really put others first in the bottom of our heart, then that is the absence of self-concern. And the absence of self-concern, we might even say, is Buddha's awakening. So, it's a little shake, like, I don't really know what Buddha's awakening is, but like, I just want everybody else to be totally free and happy. And I'm completely on board with that, and I could say, when we're completely on board with that, then we're free from our own self-concern. Or maybe just a little skillful way of talking about this. For me, it was like a little bit disturbing still, though, because we also have this Mahayana story that the reason to be a Buddha is for the benefit of all beings, that it's the best possible way to be for all beings, the most beneficial life one can have is Buddha, a Buddha life. So this is this shepherd-like bodhicitta is kind of saying, I want to postpone, I vow to postpone my Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. But isn't Buddhahood the best thing? So when I tried looking into this a little bit, I found one kind of modern Buddhist scholar who had realized the same problem. Like, well, this doesn't really make sense logically. And his understanding of this was that in an earlier version of Buddha Dharma, like early Dharma teachings, was that a Buddha is like, when one realizes Buddhahood, it's like cessation. And especially after one's human lifespan ends, there's like, it's the end. There's no more way to benefit beings. In the early version of becoming, or like an arhat, you might say. A little different from a Buddha, but even the early versions of Shakyamuni Buddha, it seems like the presentation is that after that lifespan ends of Shakyamuni Buddha, he can no longer benefit beings except through the dharma, his dharma that continues. That's the early version. And so this idea of let's help everybody before becoming a Buddha, we could be reborn again and again in the human realm, in the cycle of ordinary messy life in order to keep helping beings there. And then when everybody's free, then we can cease this cycle of messiness. So one proposal is that this shepherd-like bodhicitta is this blend of like early Buddhism where we actually don't really want to get into this cessation thing because we won't be able to help. But then later Mahayana has the teaching of what's called the non-abiding nirvana. Non-abiding nirvana doesn't abide in this cessation of perfect peace of nirvana, and it also doesn't abide in samsara, getting caught up in the messy cycle of self-centered suffering. It doesn't abide in samsara or nirvana, and that's the Mahayana, what came to be the Mahayana Buddha, is this non-abiding nirvana Buddha. And therefore, a non-abiding nirvana Buddha doesn't have to delay one's Buddhahood because they don't have to worry about no longer being able to help beings in samsara. So we might say, well, when the non-abiding nirvana teaching came into this world, then we no longer need this shepherd-like bodhicitta, right? We can say, well, you could be the king-like bodhicitta, and as a Buddha, you can keep helping forever and ever, abiding, you know, remaining in this world eternally. So, and yet, shepherd-like bodhicitta still was taught by people like Dogen. So, we might say, well, we don't really need that anymore. We don't need to postpone Buddhahood, actually. But it's the spirit, this totally selfless giving spirit of let's postpone it. We don't need to, but let's postpone it just because that's so selfless an attitude. Not so much about we want to postpone it, but more like let's just not be so concerned with our own perfect peace and just keep living for the benefit of all beings. And so Dogen talks about bodhicitta. He also says, how does this bodhicitta come to be? How does a deluded human like me generate this such a selfless aspiration? Seems almost impossible. And Dogen says, well, it actually, a sentient being can't really do this on their own. A human person with a sense of an independent self that must come first can't really just say, I vow to save all beings, you know, in this complete way where we really mean like I'm willing to give my life for the benefit of a mouse or something. We can't really do it, right? And also, Dogen says, Buddha can't really do it for us. Like, Buddha can't just, like, zap us with a Buddha beam and say, there, you have bodhicitta. But Dogen says, in the meeting, in the mystical communion of sentient beings and Buddhas, this bodhicitta is born. He uses this term kano doko, which sometimes translated as mystical communion or sympathetic resonance between sentient beings, which are like people and other beings like me who feel like, well, there's me over here and you over there, and I got to take care of this one first. These are like sentient beings. They meet, they have a mystical communion with Buddhas. And what are these Buddhas? This sounds kind of like theistic, right? Who are these Buddhas? Are they great invisible beings in the sky that we commune with? And sometimes it sounds like that, but today I see it as this is our true nature, Buddha. Right? This is the teaching of Buddha nature, is that we are who we truly are, is not the separate being over here that sees the world, the threatening world outside. But our true nature is this boundless awareness that can't be grasped in any way and is not separate from anyone else, and is completely free. Actually, it can't suffer. Doesn't know how to have a problem, actually. This boundless awareness, you could say it holds all suffering and problems, but it's not disturbed by them. It's not tainted by the misery of the world, and yet it's not separate from it in the slightest. It completely holds all of it. It doesn't resist it, and it's not afraid of it, because it holds it like a great perfect mirror. Doesn't reject any images and on the mirror, and doesn't grasp the images on the mirror, and isn't dirtied by the images on the mirror. Like that, our true nature, already free, just that we're often not in touch with it. So if that's Buddha, then it's not so much like the big Buddha in the sky or something. It's that this mystical communion is between our sentient being nature and our Buddha nature. Between, well, I'm just this person here who's just trying to get through the day. What do you mean, like, be free from all self-centeredness and give my life for the benefit of all beings throughout the universe? Like, I don't think so. Not me. But that one, meeting our true nature, which is this boundless awareness that actually is like, sure, sign me up for the bodhicitta program. I have no resistance to that. I include all beings and all beings suffering, it says, in its non-verbal way. It's open to all beings and doesn't reject anything and isn't concerned about even birth and death. Right? In this big, boundless awareness, even birth and death can come and go. So if the sentient being kind of gets in touch with that true nature, then in that mystical communion, in that sympathetic resonance, bodhicitta is born. And that story works for me, because I feel like I can say beings are numberless, I vow to save them, but if I'm really pressed if thousands of hungry cannibals suddenly came into the zendo and said, can we have your body for lunch now? I might say, no, actually, like, I come first here, okay? but if that self that says, I come first here, meets this big boundless awareness that may be, like, hard to when we're pushed around a scenario like that, maybe, like, I don't know. But sometimes we might feel that real boundlessness, where it's like, okay, many, many more bodies have come and gone here, and like, I can give this one to these hungry cannibals. Or that's not so much that I can give this one, it's more like there's this body in mind called like Kokyo, in the experience of Kokyo, that's like this fluid changing experience in the middle of this boundless awareness, and that fluid changing experience is just a very temporary occurrence anyway. So that's whatever happens. That's just whatever's most in harmony with the whole. So in that meeting, Kano Doko, Bodhicitta, the aspiration, is born. And Dogen even says, this aspiration, you start working with the discriminating mind. He talks about different kinds of minds, like kind of, you might say, big mind. Do you generate this aspiration with big mind? And he says, first, no, really, it's like mostly about discriminating conceptual mind. It's where you're actually thinking about, there's me here, and there's all these beings there, and they're suffering, and I will give this body and mind life to this whole. So it starts with this discriminating mind that we call the sentient being, but it can't do it alone. It has to meet the true nature called Buddha. And I mean, it's pretty awesome. I feel like when I start warming up to these types of teachings, because I generally then tend to kind of like, it can kind of like cause a sort of contraction in the sentient being to even consider it. In my sentient being, it's I feel like it's too much. But then I kind of settle into the bigger mind. It's like, no, for that bigger mind, it's not too much. Like, we just had Rohatsu Sesshin down in Santa Cruz, and before Sesshin, there were various people practicing the Tassajara. Right, it's like on the way north on their vacation, so people can I stay at Santa Cruz Zen Center on my vacation? A few people, maybe for a while. And I'm like, this is the time when we have no Zendo schedule between, like, you know, Christmas and New Year's. It's a vacation time of year, and I'm a kind of a, personally, my sentient being nature is in kind of like this, I would say, the introvert category. I've once heard introverts defined as those who get their energy from being alone. They get their life energy from being spending a lot of time alone, and extroverts get their life energy from constantly being with people. And I think I'm more the introvert. Wow, I have this week where there's no schedule. I maybe could even get away with, like, not seeing anybody for a week. What a treat this would be. So I, well, see, Tassajara visitors, why don't you come by for a cup of tea on your way to wherever you're going to go. And at the end of Sesshin, I just felt like that bigger mind is just more available. Like, the heart was more open, and I wrote those people back and said, you all can come, stay as long as you want. Just come. So I thought something like, I'm not saying that's bodhicitta exactly, but it's a bigger openness to just be with suffering beings. Bodhicitta itself, you know, like, how it's classically defined. I recently came across a teaching from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who we might think of as the incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. So open to other suffering, such a big mind, so compassionate and joyful in the face of so much pain. And he said something like, when talking about bodhicitta, how great it is, and how this is, like, really what makes a bodhisattva. And he says, by the way, I don't have this bodhicitta at all, even in the slightest bit. Oh, and this may be a big thing. the Dalai Lama's doesn't have even a trace of it. And he says, but I aspire to bodhicitta. I aspire to have such an aspiration. Because I'm totally convinced that it's the greatest mind and way to be. But I'm working on it. So I heard that, I felt more okay. More allowed with it. So maybe discuss it a little bit, or if you have any comments or questions about this awesome topic. Yes.
I'm just thinking that in Chan and Zen, they talk about great compassion.
Yeah.
Could you say something about that?
I think it comes from I think in Abhidharma Kosha there's even this term Maha Karuna. That's as I recall, I think it's defined there as something like compassion is this wish, may all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. The great compassion there is like when it's boundless and impartial. We might say in the categories of what type of suffering, not just like may they be well fed and housed, but more like may they be completely free from self-concern, may they be completely awakened and Buddhas themselves. That's the type of suffering we're talking about, free from. And all beings is not just like the humans in California or something, but the six realms of sentient beings, ones we can't even see or imagine, even like hell realms and hungry ghost realms, and not even just in our solar system or universe, but in boundless universes, wherever there's sentience, there's suffering. I think sentience means like some type of like nervous system where there's which creates a sense of pain. And wherever there's pain, may it cease. Wherever there's a sense of a center of a self, may this illusion dissolve. And so boundless freedom from suffering, boundless sentient beings, and impartial, meaning like, well, first let's like save those that we really love closest to us, and then the ones like in distant Africa or something, we'll work up to them gradually, mile by mile or something, or more and more and less related to us. So I think the great compassion is like we impartially wish this for all beings without like bias. So I think that's the Abhidharma thing, and if we might even go further and say these are all very kind of conceptual ideas, and that the Zen great compassion, we could say we have to go beyond like any limited conceptual understanding here, because it's too much. So it has to be also in Zen. It has to be right here and now. It can't be some distant future. In one moment, there could be one moment of completely open, clear heart. And sometimes I think we do tap into that. We might even feel for a second or two, I'm actually feel so open now. I'm willing to give my life for all beings. Sure. So I think more than one or two seconds might be hard to sustain. And personally speaking, anyway. But we could say that moment is like a complete moment. And every moment is, that's the nature of every moment. It's just, it's just obscured by my personal habits. So we might say Buddha is always here in the Zen non-dual version. We could say bodhicitta is also always here. It's just this very, very hair's breadth difference is as the distance between bodhicitta and total self-centeredness. And that hair's breadth difference is like, well, nothing really. Maybe that's the Zen version of great compassion. And it's that hair, tiny hair, is nothing really, and yet that tiny hair, if we pick it up, is like a distance between heaven and earth. Yes.
So there's the aspiration that all beings are free of suffering.
Yeah.
And we're aspiring to get to that aspiration. Or,
yeah.
So is there, how does that translate into action?
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Yeah, yeah. So in the classic presentation of this, which is, you know, I like nice road maps for these things, that actually it's spoken of, there's the relative bodhicitta and the ultimate bodhicitta. So this maybe also gets into the Zen. Zen tends to emphasize the ultimate. And the ultimate bodhicitta is like awakened mind, the already perfectly complete awakened mind that that's already imminent. And then the relative bodhicitta is like where we're kind of working up to opening that already present mind. And the relative bodhicitta has these two aspects that are called aspiration bodhicitta and implementation bodhicitta, we might say, or bodhicitta in action. So it is part of bodhicitta, is the aspiration. The aspiration is often so focused on because you could say all action comes from intention. So that a lot of Dharma is really working on really clarifying our ultimate concern, our aspirations, our intentions. And with that clarified, then one take would be, then naturally action comes forth from that. But it is part of implementation bodhicitta, is like they say, the aspirations like making the plan to go from Santa Cruz to San Francisco, and then the implementation is like getting in Tom's car and going. And the way it's defined, that the implementation or bodhicitta in action is the six paramitas. A lot of you probably know of the six paramitas, the six bodhisattva practices of great boundless giving, generosity, harmlessness. I've been playing with different translations for these recently. Giving, harmlessness, sometimes we'd say like virtue, patience, diligence, presence. You know, dhyana is Zen. You know, we say concentration or meditation. I've been playing with presence, paramita. And openness, prajna paramita is the openness paramita, which is, we would say, wisdom. So these six are like, once the aspiration, okay, I'm on board, I vow now to give my life for the benefit of all beings, there's nothing more important than this, now what do I do? Now what? So I think this is a great list. And the more I hear this list of these six practices, the more I feel like this is everything. Everything's included in the Bodhisattva's practice of these six aspects, starting with giving. Okay, I'm going to give this life to all beings. I'm going to give materially. I'm going to give dharmically. I'm going to give protection from fear to those in fear. And then harmlessness. Well, if I'm living to end suffering of all beings, let's start with not harming them. And also kind of tempers the giving. because at first this is this exuberant feeling. I'm going to give everything. And then the harmlessness is like, actually, there's certain things that would be better not to give. Like sometimes it's even listed, like weapons. Don't give weapons of mass destruction. It is a kind of giving, but actually don't do that one. It's kind of like refraining is that harmlessness, the virtue side. And then patience is like usually in response to anger, patience with all kinds of suffering, but particularly the harm of other sentient beings that say like, actually, I know you want to like help all beings, so actually, please give me your eyeball now. In fact, I'm not even going to wait for you to give it to me. I'm going to like cut it out myself. So the bodhisattva is like, I'm going to be patient with this situation. I'm going to not respond to anger with anger is patience. And then diligence is this great enthusiastic effort to keep going. It's kind of like patience. Sometimes I kind of see like giving and this harmlessness are sort of like a yin and yang. It's part of the same thing. Like giving is this very active outward directed sending out everything, and harmlessness is kind of like the more almost like restraint, even not what we're not doing. And similarly, the patience is kind of like the that sort of not what we're not doing. We're not getting angry back, retaliating. And diligence is like the outward kind of yang, energetic, directed aspect that balances that. And then also we could see like this presence of jhana and the openness of prajna are like a pair too. So yeah, and then of course day-to-day life, how those play out is like myriad ways, but I think considering those six practices as like the all-encompassing bodhisattva's way is I find really helpful. Even kind of like going through them once in a while, wow, I'm really doing a lot of this dhyana. I'm sitting a lot of zazen, but how about my like generosity practice and patience with difficulty and so on? So aspiration, application, that was the word I was looking for. Aspiration bodhicitta and application bodhicitta. Application being these six bodhisattva practices. And but they're fueled by this aspiration. I really feel like both this bodhicitta and the aspiration aspect, I really feel like it's the fuel for practice. And I just notice when I'm starting to kind of doubt the practice or get lazy or kind of start going through the motions. Yeah, I am doing it. I can't really escape it living at the Zen Center, right? In this role, but kind of like I'm just doing it. But it's kind of like the fire behind it is kind of smoldering. It's kind of like we need to add some fuel to the fire. It's just really considering this this aspiration. And in a way, the aspiration is fueled by compassion, which is basically remembering suffering, my own and others. And it's like, as soon as it, remember, there is like big time discontent in this world, really getting in touch with that more and more, that we're adding some kindling to the fire, and then it's like, but I think it's possible to actually like end this. Maybe not just talk about completely ending it for all beings throughout the universe, we might not think that that's possible. Some do think it's possible, but we might think, well, isn't it the best thing to, what else would be more important than putting our energy towards that, even if it's a long process? And then, this is Dogen's discriminating mind. Maybe if we contemplate these things, and then we think, well, what's the best way to go about addressing this massive suffering? Well, what about Buddha mind? And then bodhicitta comes in. Dogen's got another, oh, it's late, huh? I was gonna say, Dogen's got one essay called Awakening Bodhicitta and one essay called Awakening the Unsurpassed Mind, which is also bodhicitta. So it's two different essays, and they're completely different, almost no overlap between them. And the Hotsu Mujo Shin is, he says, bodhicitta is more like just doing these things, like building bridges for people to cross over rivers, and building stupas to honor Buddhas. And people might argue that, well, these are just constructed activities. What's this have to do with Buddha's mind? But he says, well, if you say they're just conditioned, contrived activity, then everything is conditioned, contrived activity. So actually, what you do moment to moment, making some food and offering it to somebody, this is bodhicitta in this other essay of Dogen's. So, thanks for the opportunity to remember this amazing mind once again. Bodhicitta, and bodhisattvas can also dedicate the merit of any wholesome activity. So we offer anything positive arisen here to all beings throughout space and time. May our intentions ease their pain, even in the slightest bit. And may the precious mind of bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen, may it never wane, but further and further increase.
May our intention equally extend to every being.